Our second lecture this evening brings us to part three of the course, what I've called Reformation Resolutions, Augustinian Beginnings, Medieval Developments, Reformation Resolutions. And the first lecture has to do with a general introduction to the Reformation. The interest here is and has to do with how is the Reformation rightly viewed from an historiographical standpoint. And so by way of general introduction, notice first of all conflicting perspectives. There has been in recent years a tremendous burst of interest in the Reformation. I wrote that 20 or 30 years ago, but it's still true. Spitz speaks of a renaissance of Reformation studies. Surprisingly, to conservative evangelicals, this interest has been very great among neo-Orthodox scholars. This renewed interest has been marked by vastly differing perspectives on the Reformation. Spitz has edited a book entitled The Reformation Material or Spiritual. You might have thought that that was obvious, but it's not to some historiographers. And W. Stanford Reed, fine historian, edited another book entitled The Reformation Revival or Revolution. For convenience, the different interpretations of the Reformation may be classified as the Protestant, the Catholic, and the secular. First of all, the Protestant interpretation. The classic statement of this interpretation is perhaps that of J.H. Merle d'Aubigné. For him, we had to read d'Aubigné's Reformation when I was at Trinity Ministerial Academy, all 800, 900 pages. What it lacks in modern historiography, it more than makes up for in the warmth of his presentation as the kind of classic Protestant point of view. For him, the Reformation is the Great Reformation, a great religious revival which must be ascribed to God's action in history. Differences do, of course, exist among Protestants. Lutherans stress the importance of Lutherans' religious genius. Such admiration has sometimes been carried to an extreme by German nationalism. Gerhard Ritter utters these sentiments. Martin Luther's importance for the world is most easily reflected in our own example. Indeed, it was in Germany that his work came nearest to having its desired effect. And it's surely true that in his whole manner and character, he is far more easily accessible and familiar to us than to other people, simply because we can feel that he belongs to us as a German. There was a time when our young students used to feed him with overwhelming enthusiasm as a German hero, as the ideal of German manhood. Those youths went off to fight in the War of Liberation against Napoleon and returned home with high ideals of a new, free, unified, but also devout Germany, liberated from the false faith of the Italians. See what's going on here. Today we have moved far from the excesses of early German nationalism, yet why should this prevent us from recognizing certain characteristic traits of the German national character with its strengths, its weaknesses, and dangers in Martin Luther? Well, that's an interesting statement given that it was written in the decade in which Adolf Hitler was rising to power in Germany. Read in that light, there's some very interesting naivete, at least, in what the guy is saying. Those in the Reformed tradition, while recognizing the importance of Luther, stress the theological genius of Calvin as well as the importance of Zwingli, Knox, and Cranmer. The Anabaptist tradition usually, to some extent, disclaims Reformation heritage. This is manifested in the tendency to speak of the restitution of Christianity rather than the reformation of Christianity. You might want to talk about the restoration of Christianity or the restitution of Christianity, but it was John Calvin that wrote the Institutes of the Christian Religion, and it was Michael Servetus that wrote the Restitution of Christianity. Think about that. Still, Well-known historians of the Anabaptist tradition relate Anabaptism to the Reformation. Note G.H. Williams, the Radical Reformation, and Leonard Verdine, the Reformers and their stepchildren. G.H. Williams' book, The Radical Reformation, if I recall, is about 800 pages, and very interested in its schema because it divides Anabaptists, the Radical Reformation, into three groups. The spiritual Anabaptist, the spiritualist Anabaptist, and you can think of them as mystics anticipating the Quakers. The rationalistic Anabaptist, i.e. men like Servetus, the anti-Trinitarians, and the Socinians, and the evangelical Anabaptist, which is what most Baptists like to trace, if they understand the distinction at all, their origin back to. At any rate, Williams' book, The Radical Reformation, is I think, pretty important. Well, that's the Protestant interpretation. What is the Catholic interpretation of the Reformation? You may have never thought about that, but what do they do with it? Roman Catholics could not, of course, allow the Protestant views to go unanswered. Thus, the history of the Protestant, this historian of the Protestant Reformation, Flaccius Illyricus, wrote the Magdeburg Centuries. And this was answered by the history of Cardinal Baronius, the Annals of the Church, Annales Ecclesiasticae, 1588 to 1607. For Catholics, of course, this historical event was not the Reformation, but the deformation of the Church. The original Catholic strategy was to attack the Reformers' doctrine as heretical, and their lives as wicked. They were thus led to dredge up every piece of information, true or false, which tended to establish this attack. This tactic has been modified recently in the interest of ecumenicity, and perhaps also under the pressure of historical fact. The old polemic and element of truth in it is, however, still visible in other Catholic treatments. Note, for instance, Hugh Ross Williamson's treatment of the English Reformation entitled The Reformation, an Expression of Greed. Well, and of course you can see the element of truth in that if you think about Henry VIII. And then there are secular interpretations. Let me give you a description of them. The secular interpretations are both more varied and, probably, you will think, more bizarre. Most, if not all, agree, however, in depreciating the religious character of the Reformation. Religious change is thus seen as the result, not the cause, of the forces at work in the Reformation. Different secular interpreters, then, will stress different forces, either economic forces, political or social factors as primary. This is the Reformation taken by Marxist. Did you know there was a Marxist view of the Reformation? Strangely enough. They stress economic factors, of course. Others stress intellectual factors as primary. Dilthey, for instance, calls the Reformation the religious expression in Northern Europe of the Renaissance and humanism. In this view, the doctrine of justification by faith alone is seen as an affirmation of moral and religious autonomy. Interesting. Say, how in the world did they get there? Well, I mean, what they stress is that justification by faith alone says you don't need the church to be justified, and so it's an expression of moral and religious autonomy. You can be justified by your own faith, which is to turn on its head the strict Augustinianism of all the original reformers, but that's what they say. The difficulties with the secular interpretations. The secular interpretation involves reading the relation of the Reformation and the Renaissance in a way which sees the Renaissance as preeminent. Now, this point of view must now be discussed. First of all, we have to think of the ambiguous meaning of the Renaissance. Maybe rather shocking, it was shocking for me certainly, the first time I read Calvin described as a young French humanist. Of course, the word humanist here has a slightly different meaning in the 16th century context than it does in the 21st century context. Was Calvin a humanist? That is to say, a Renaissance man dedicated to the new scholarship, the discoveries of the Renaissance with regard to antiquities. This question and the more general question of the relation of the Reformation to the Renaissance depends very greatly on our definition of the Renaissance. If one defines Renaissance humanism as the scholarly endeavor to return to the original sources, to more pure age and understanding, a critique of the degenerate church and scholasticism of the age than present, then one may see how Calvin may be described as a young humanist. This master of the Latin language was also, as we're going to see next week, had the privilege of being trained by some of the foremost Greek and Hebrew scholars of the day. And his knowledge of and ability to write pure Latin, his determination to return to the sources of Christianity, the Greek New Testament, the Hebrew Old Testament, in order to purify the church, would certainly qualify him for such a title. Luther also would qualify under such a definition of terms. However, if one defines the Renaissance as others do, such a description of Luther and Calvin would scarcely be appropriate. Such definitions are, quote, the rediscovery of man and the world, or making the moral and religious autonomy of the person the basis of spiritual life. Now, only a bizarre amount of ignorance of where Luther and Calvin were coming from could ever look at them in that light. The mere fact that they were both strict Augustinians makes those point of views, those kind of points of view, kind of ridiculous. But let's go now to the superficial. This should be a B, by the way. I'm sorry. The superficial similarity of the Renaissance to the Reformation. The difficulty is that the Reformation does bear a superficial resemblance to the Renaissance in two areas where, in fact, it is fundamentally at odds with humanism. E. Troeltsch describes these two areas as, one, religious individualism, and two, the ethics of world affirmation. These two areas correspond to the definition of the Renaissance just cited, the rediscovery of man and the world. Religious individualism, first of all, there is a sense in which the Reformation was individualistic. Sola Scriptura and Sola Fide cut the shackles which bound the Christian man to the absolutely authoritative church. Troeltsch is right. However, when he says Protestantism is individualistic only in comparison with Catholic authority, Protestantism cuts man off from the control of the authoritarian church, but not from the control of a sovereign God and his written word. Protestantism, in fact, rejects the Renaissance ideal of autonomous man. So, what about the ethics of world affirmation? By the ethics of world affirmation is meant that system of ethics which rejects asceticism and monasticism and emphasizes the importance of the world. Again, at least upon superficial view, the Renaissance and Reformation appear to be in agreement here. Both affirmed the world and rejected asceticism. Humanism, however, rejected any meaningful otherworldliness. In the end, it was as worldly as a pig. In certain respects, in fact, Protestantism was, if anything, more otherworldly than Catholicism. Protestantism saw man's place in the world in terms of vocation, a job to do. Humanism's idea was the homo universal, the universal man, freed from the trammels of the mundane for the purpose of self-expression. The Reformation was God-centered with a pessimistic view of man. The Renaissance was man and world-centered with an optimistic view of man. When Erasmus, the quintessential representative of the Renaissance in a religious mood, broke with Luther, this was clearly manifested. He chose to break with Luther by writing a treatise on the freedom of the human will, the natural view of one with an optimistic view of man. Luther's response epitomized the ultimate point of cleavage between Renaissance and Reformation. He replied with his classic treatise on the bondage of the human will. So De Libero, our B3O, was answered by De Cerville, our B3O. So general assessments. Before giving a general assessment of the conflicting perspectives examined above, something must be said about the standard by which all historical movements should be judged. The first thing that must be said is that all secular views of history, and especially the Reformation, ultimately drown in the shoreless sea of relativity. The secular historian of the Reformation, a man, interestingly, with a Puritan-like name, Preserved Smith, admits this, in fact, when he says of his own view of the Reformation, "Of course, no view can be final. Mine, like that of everyone else, is the expression of an age and an environment as well as that of an individual. So, on what grounds should we pay any attention to it, then, Mr. Smith?" Spitz expresses the unavoidable frustration of non-Christian historiography when he says, "It is paradoxical, in fact, that nature seems to be more unambiguously susceptible to human understanding and control than is history, which man makes and in which he is personally and intimately involved." The paradox just mentioned is resolved only when we understand that history is the work of God and under his control alone. This means that God and his word must be the standard by which all historical movements must be understood and evaluated. Since only God stands outside and above history, he alone provides the absolute, the standard by which it may be judged. There is no possibility of an internal standard internal to history which may stand in judgment over it and by which it may be evaluated. Having understood this, only one conclusion is possible about the Reformation for us as Protestants and evangelical Calvinists. We must regard it as a revival of Christianity and Christian truth. This is so because the Reformation gave prominence to and fixed ineradicably on the face of the history of the Church what as Protestants we hold to be important aspects of Christian truth and practice. The Reformation was therefore fundamentally a religious movement rather than a political, social, or economic one. The divine character of the Reformation does not, however, give us the right to vilify all who oppose it and deify all who support it. Or sanctify them, if you don't like deify. Very often in Protestant historiography, the wicked traits of the Protestant princes were passed over, while those of the Catholic cardinals were placed under the magnifying glass. If we remember Jesus' parable of the dragnet and Paul's assertion that this is a present evil age, we will not regard any historical movement as unmixed good. Furthermore, the religious character of the Reformation does not necessitate unduly ignoring or depreciating other movements which contributed to the eventual outbreak of the Reformation. There were undoubtedly political, economic, social, intellectual, and scientific realities and movements associated with it, and in some degree preparatory of it. To admit other factors is not to deny the divine and religious character of the Reformation. It is only to recognize in it the God who works by second causes and who controls all of history, including the political, intellectual, scientific parts of it. Contributing factors. Having thus admitted that various factors were at work in bringing about the Reformation, we'll now examine the major factors which contributed to that great historical transformation which we call the Reformation. We will speak first of the preparatory factors and then of the galvanizing factor. Preparatory factors. It's proper to speak of the two centuries preceding the Reformation, approximately 1300 to 1500, as the waning Middle Ages, or the decline of the medieval synthesis. The Thomistic intellectual synthesis was being undercut by the nominalism of Duns Scotus and Ockham. The temporal supremacy of the Pope was beginning to be more and more undercut and thus difficult to make effective because of the growing power of the nation states. The moral and religious supremacy of the papacy over the Church was declining because of schism in the papacy itself and pervasive moral corruption in the Church. It is important to look in more detail at these three realms, so intellectual preparations for the Reformation. The medieval synthesis of all reality into one comprehensive system was built on Neoplatonic presuppositions inherited through Augustine from Greek philosophy. Platonism insisted that the material world was patterned upon a higher reality of ideas or forms or universals. These universals could be known by men, in fact, were the basis of all human knowledge. Neoplatonism taught that the entire universe was a logical hierarchy ascending to God. Human society was structured on this hierarchical pattern. The civil and ecclesiastical hierarchies reflected it. The intellectual synthesis which Neoplatonism predisposed the medieval church to erect reached its highest point in the system of Thomas Aquinas. This system, however, contained the seeds of its own destruction. Thomas used, with most other scholastics, the popular new Aristotelian philosophy. Aristotle, in contrast to Neoplatonism, emphasized not the universal but the particular. It was the particulars of the material world, not the universals of the ideal world, which really mattered, which were really real. The universal was a mere name, not ultimate reality. This Aristotelian philosophy was therefore known as nominalism, while Neoplatonism was known as realism. Though Thomas Aquinas restrained the destructive influence of such a philosophy upon his system, the systems of Scotus and Occam began clearly to manifest this tendency. The nominalists denied that human beings could have a definite perception of ultimate reality. Knowledge was limited to particulars. Ultimate reality was by implication not subject to human logic. This tended to undercut the scholastic optimism with respect to reason. Faith began to be set over against reason rather than seen as allied with it. This is true. If you're committed to nominalism, even in its more modern forms like evangelical empiricism and so forth, you're going to have to end up saying, as they do say, that our knowledge of even the existence of God is only probability because it's all based on inductive reasoning. Platonists and their modern descendants, the Christian rationalists, are going to say, no, we can have a more definite and certain knowledge of spiritual things based upon the deductions of our reasons. So deductive philosophy and reasoning gives you certainty, but raises other questions that are difficult. At any rate, what faith knew and believed on authority from the church, according to these late scholastics, new authority from the church might be unprovable, might even contradict reason. The nominalists did not intend to reject orthodox doctrine. They were determined to believe the church, no matter if it contradicted reason. Occam said that he knew a doctrine of the Lord's Supper just as scriptural and more reasonable than transubstantiation, but nevertheless followed the dogma of the church. The nominalists were led by their position to assert that God was so absolutely powerful that he might literally do anything, i.e., yes, become incarnate in an ass, or forgive sins without atonement. The Thomistic theology was known as the Via Antiqua. The Occamist theology is the Via Moderna. The Via Moderna dominated theological education at the time of the Reformation. Luther, for instance, was trained in it, and it is against it, such of training that he addressed some of his most worst invective. The effect of nominalism was to destroy the older theology to find itself unable to construct a more viable one. Theological discussion became hopelessly complex. This undercut public confidence in the scholastics and laid them open to the devastating criticism of Erasmus and the humanist. The humanistic movement was marked by a revival of interest in classical studies, which demanded a knowledge of the Greek language. Greek became the common possession of educated people. Of immense significance and impetus for humanistic studies was the invention of printing with movable type. This made it possible to preserve and spread far and wide the fruits of scholarly study. It became possible to prepare critical editions of many important works, including the New Testament. Erasmus published such a Greek text, Testament, in 1516. Either that one or a successive one that he published was the Textus Receptus. In Spain, a group of scholars under Cardinal Francisco Ximenes de Cisneros published the Complutensian Polyglot Bible, which consisted of parallel columns of the Bible in Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, and Latin. In Italy, Lorenzo Vaia applied the principles of textual criticism to the so-called Donation of Constantine and discovered that it was spurious. By 1500, the printers, most of them humanist, had printed over 40,000 works and 10 million volumes. Those are the intellectual preparations. There were also religious preparations for the Reformation. The cry for Reformation had been in the air for centuries. It may be traced to a Cistercian monk, according to one author, who died in 1202. So, why did the Reformation come in 1517? Yes, that is the question. It was the declining moral authority of the church's hierarchy which lay at the basis of the continuing cries for Reformation. Three events especially were responsible for this declining authority. The move of the papacy to Avignon in France, called the Babylonian Captivity of the Church, which tied the papacy to French national interests. Two, the Great Western Schism, in which at one point there were three competing popes. And third, the capture of the papacy by the spirit of the Italian Renaissance. Each of these events were also accompanied by heavy financial needs. Since Rome had only religion to sell, in order to pay for such expenses, it sold religion and made itself odious in the eyes of the world. There was a real desire for reformation within the Roman Church. It cried out for thorough moral reformation of the hierarchy. It wanted a pure Catholic church. Even today, Catholics still insist that it was moral, not doctrinal, certainly not structural reformation that was necessary. So yes, reformation was necessary, moral reformation, but certainly not the doctrine or structure of the church. There were political preparations for the Reformation. The Reformation coincided with the unification of three major European nation-states. Spain was unified in the last quarter of the 15th century. England was unified in the period around 1500. France entered the 16th century as a unified kingdom. These political changes sparked economic changes and also made the peoples of Europe more difficult for the papacy to manipulate or control. But all those were contributing factors. The galvanizing factor, I think we must admit, was Martin Luther. To its contemporaries, the Reformation was an extraordinary event. It looked as amazing to them as it has looked to Protestants since then. Furthermore, in the words of Joseph Lortz, the immediate cause of the Reformation was Martin Luther. The perceived importance of this man is indicated in the fact that by 1950, now 63 years ago, when I wrote that 40 years ago, over 3,000 biographies and treatises about Luther had been written. Luther was the catalyst of the Reformation. But the great question is, why did the Reformation come with Luther? It is true, of course, that a great debate has raged over this question. Was Luther at first unique in preaching his doctrines? Some historians have maintained that he was not unique, while others have maintained the opposite. Some have found Zwingli saying approximately the same things, for instance, at approximately the same time. Yeah, while this question is not without interest, no one can doubt that it was Luther's name and personality which both then and now is preeminently associated with the Reformation. Since the Reformation was a work of God, the Reformation came with and is preeminently associated with Luther because God so willed it. God prepared the man for the times and the times for the man. The man was Martin Luther. The further question, however, presses. Why did God so will? Why was it that the Reformation was embodied in Martin Luther? It lived in him as in no one else. The reason, I believe, is that God intended to teach the church several lessons of great importance through Luther and his experience. The first lesson, we'll look at Luther's life in the last lecture this evening, but The first lesson concerns the question discussed above as to the nature of the Reformation. If Luther embodied the Reformation, if it lived in him as in no one else, then it is proper to estimate its essence from what he and the other reformers thought they were doing. And then we must say that the Reformation was fundamentally religious. Additional proof for the religious character of Reformation is that 100 editions of the Bible were printed between 1457 and 1500. The second lesson concerns the reason for Luther's success in initiating thoroughgoing Reformation when for two centuries others had failed of this goal. Remember, there had been calls for Reformation for centuries. Well, why did Luther's Reformation succeed? The reason is connected with the fact that Luther demanded more than merely moral and administrative reformation. He demanded doctrinal and structural reformation in the church. Only this struck at the root of the problems in the church which others had ignored for 200 years. Roland Baton makes this perceptive comment about Luther. He began with the religion and theology on which he had been reared and discovered there genuine difficulties to which others were not properly sensitive. Luther saw a problem in the givens of scholastic theology. He felt the problem, indeed, in a way others did not. He had a peculiar religious insight rooted in his profound religious earnestness. He saw more clearly because he felt more deeply. That's the point. The third lesson grows out of this. It was Luther's deep personal religious experience of the doctrine he was preaching which gave such extraordinary power to it for doctrinal reform. Luther's own religious experience most clearly and dramatically displayed the inadequacy of Catholicism and the power of the truth of sola fide. Finally, we must learn something of the extraordinary and peculiar gifts which Luther had been granted. He possessed tremendous gifts of leadership. Additionally, Luther was a powerful pamphleteer. No, he was not the theologian that Calvin was or Melanchthon was, but boy, could he write tracts. Luther was a powerful pamphleteer. His pamphlets may be marred by exaggeration and invective, but they lost none of their effectiveness or power for all that. Two factors immensely enhanced the usefulness of Luther's gift: the invention of the printing press and his assistance at the university and in the church. Before 1517, Luther had converted the whole university to his cause. Theological significance, then. Introduction. The theological significance of the Reformation is highlighted in the experience of its great historian, J.H. Merle d'Aubigné. D'Aubigné was one of a number of students converted through the ministry of Robert Haldane. Well, d'Aubigné was at the University of Geneva studying for the ministry under the influence of a faculty of theology permeated by Unitarianism. Haldane began his ministry in Geneva. Haldane invited a number of students to his lodgings where he expounded to them the doctrines of the Reformation. This was the beginning of a great revival on the continent of Europe, which spanned the years 1815 to 1830. Many of Haldane's students became eminent in this Second Reformation, J.H. Merle d'Aubigné and Adolphe Monod among them. The doctrines of the Reformation have two striking characteristics which confirm their importance for Christian theology and explain their influence upon the students mentioned above. First of all, we must consider their homogeneity. There is a striking uniformity among the reformers with regard to Christian truth. The uniformity of this theology is all the more striking because it professed to recognize no living earthly human authority, but rather professed subjection only to the divinely authoritative Word of God. An illustration and proof of this is provided, by the colloquy of Marburg. It was, of course, at this colloquy that the political unity between Lutheran and Zwinglian principalities was broken on the rocks of disagreement over the nature of the real presence in the Lord's Supper. It is striking that in the midst of the sharpest division, one can find a proof of the unity of the Reformation theology, for only on one part of 14 articles of faith was there disagreement. To Luther's discredit, he insisted on division over that one part of 14 articles, but nonetheless, that's the fact. This unity included orthodoxy with respect to the Trinity and the person of Christ, strict Augustinianism with respect to the doctrines of sin, grace, and predestination, agreement on the principles of sola fide and sola fide and sola scriptura, and a common opposition to doctrines of the church and sacraments, which disrupted the sola fide or sola scriptura. They also together denounced the mystics who claimed continuing revelation and disrupted the authority of scripture. The list of common areas could be continued in other areas like the use of the law, etc. The often acrimonious debates and the later departures of the Lutherans from strict Augustinianism should not disguise the amazing theological unity of Luther, Bucer, Zwingli, Keckel, and Pottius, Calvin, and many others. But there is also their advance, not only their homogeneity on many doctrines, but their advance, even more striking than the homogeneity of the theology of the Reformation, it's its clear historical progression. There's dogmatic progress visible in the theology of the Reformation. Just as Athanasius and Nicaea wrought out the doctrine of the Trinity, Augustine the doctrines of sin and grace, and Chalcedon the doctrine of the person of Christ, so now Luther and the Reformers, with a new clarity, see and articulate the doctrine of justification. Romanism now takes its place with Arianism, Pelagianism, Apollinarianism, Nestorianism, and Eutychianism as a recognized, read it, foe of Christian truth. Of immense interest, then, is the fact that this advance was acknowledged by the very foes of Luther's doctrine of justification. Buchanan, in his treatise on justification, a lengthy account of the response of the Council of Trent to Luther's doctrine of justification, remarks, quote, "They seem, indeed, to have been much perplexed in dealing with the subject. It was felt to be singularly important, as all the heirs of Luther resolved themselves into his doctrine concerning it, and also singularly difficult, since justification by faith was regarded by many as a doctrine which had never been thought of by any school writer, and therefore never discussed or confuted before." Buchanan remarks in the same place that the decrees against justification are much more dogmatic than the Council's positive exposition of it. He also shows that various Catholic theologians held different aspects of the Protestant doctrine. The Catholic confusion is symptomatic of the fact that they stood in a less advanced as well as more errant place in the history of dogma. This advance is solidly rooted, of course, in the best conviction of earlier Christians. Justification by faith alone is not new in that sense. Yet it is clear from the reaction of the Roman Catholic theologians that from the perspective of intensive theological investigation, and dogmatic formulation, new ground is being broken. James Orr, in his book, The Progress of Dogma, has rightly seen the advance which took place at the Reformation. He has also correctly seen that this advance is not to be narrowly confined in our thought to one isolated doctrine. Justification cannot be isolated from many other doctrines, including the uses of the law, the relation of the law and gospel, the relation of sanctification, good works, and regeneration to justification, the claim of tradition in the church on the Christian's obedience, the importance of this obedience to his salvation, and the relation of the sacraments to justification. Orr is right in saying that the whole of subjective soteriology came up for examination during the Reformation, but right at the heart of it all, at the center of all these doctrines, is the doctrine of justification by faith alone. What all of this says to us is that the theology of the Reformation is of vast importance. Our understanding of it will furnish us with insights into the heart and marrow of the gospel. The study of the theology of the Reformation cannot be of small importance to us. All right. Questions about all of that? Yes, Dave.
The sentence under general assessments, so the first thing must be said is that all secular views of history, and especially the Reformation, ultimately drown in the shoreless sea of relativity.
Right.
Did you make that up?
I'm sure I borrowed it from somebody, like Cornelius Van Til or somebody. Well, thank you. Dave likes the statement about the shoreless sea of relativity, and I made sure that he knew that it probably wasn't original with me. John Ferguson asked, do you think the Reformation had a greater societal impact than the Renaissance, or are they too intertwined to distinguish? That's a great question, John. I would be inclined to the opinion that the Reformation had a greater societal impact because the religious commitments of people are the most basic things about them. But if you take the Renaissance as containing the seeds of the Enlightenment, of course, then you have to say, and I think that's probably a right way to understand it, then you have to say that there is some, we must not underestimate the importance of the Renaissance, but when it was divided from the Reformation, it had a negative influence, I guess I want to say. Other questions? Okay. Next hour, we'll come to Martin Luther.